Okay. We are on Perek Kufas, chapter 128.
Yeah.
Chapter 128. Okay, this is the ninth of 15 Shir HaMaalos. The chapters, the Kapitulot that start with the word Shir HaMaalos, the Song of Ascents, that David HaMelech wrote after he completed the large chapter Kuf Yotes 119, and these 15 Shir HaMaalos were designed to provide 15 different lessons that David HaMelech thought would be relevant to how a person could move to higher and higher levels of spiritual accomplishments. These 15 chapters of Tehillim were sung on the 15 steps of the Beis HaMikdash, and each chapter was sung louder and in a higher key and in the next step. So we're on the ninth of the 15 Shir HaMaalos, and here David HaMelech is going to address the basic concerns of a man: livelihood, marriage, and children. It's hard to imagine. Yeah. So let's jump right into it. Verse 1, Pasuk Aleph says, Shir HaMaalos, Ashrei Kol Yirei Hashem, Aholech Tidracha. A song of ascents, praiseworthy, happy is every man who fears Hashem, who walks in his ways. So happy, or praiseworthy, is the person who fears Hashem, meaning that the only thing he fears is that he might not do what Hashem wants. Sephardo has a very interesting explanation of this pasuk. He says that it reflects the people's need to search for things when they feel insecure. So in Gullis, outside of Eretz Yisrael, we feel insecure, and we tend to seek security in material things, especially money. People feel more secure the more money they have.
No matter what the timing is.
And there's no objective facts to that. As far as people are seeking security through ways that really are just silly. He says, however, a person who wants security, Yirei Hashem, is a person who fears Hashem. And if you want to find security in physical things, he says, you find it in raising a large and close-knit family. And one of the things that we struggle with today in our times is that a close-knit family has become almost a thing of the past in terms of our extended families. Most families have people living all over the country, if not all over the world. That is not what Hashem intended. There are people, I remember at a certain event, it was many years ago, I don't remember the details, but there were two brothers who lived in different parts of the country, hadn't seen each other in 5 years. That is not what Hashem intended. A family does not mean just mommy and daddy and the kids. The whole extended family is what he means. So, just to repeat it over, he came in. In verse 1, it says, Shir HaMaalos, Ashrei Kol Yirei Hashem, Aholech Bedracha, the Song of Ascents. Happy is a man who fears Hashem and who walks in his ways. So fearing Hashem refers to the fact that a person who fears Hashem only fears Hashem and doesn't fear anything except that he might not do that which Hashem wants. Now this Forno puts in another, whole other meaning to this pasuk. Because a person that fears Hashem, we tend to, and walks in his ways, we tend to, he says, in Gullis, seek security through material things. We feel insecure, but we feel better if we have a lot of money. Or we feel better if we have a large number of possessions. We seek security through false methods, such as money, etc. But real security comes from walking in the ways of Hashem, and says this is far enough from raising a large and close-knit family. So that's what real security, if you want something that will really make you feel secure, that you have something that will help you, your money will not help you. Your possessions will not help you. But if you really want something that you can look to and say, look at this, look what I have, then have a family that's close-knit. And I was mentioning that you know, nowadays we struggle with this. Families have members all over the country, all over the world. It's not the way Hashem intended it. a child should have his or her babi and zaidi and family, all extended family lives. Nowadays, the way we do it, it's hard to have a close-knit family, because the family is usually scattered all over. The Sforno says, if you want real security, you want to know what real security is, have a family, a large family that's close-knit and close together.
You have to live near them.
It's hard to do that if you don't live near them, correct. Now it says, Kol Yirei Hashem, all the Yirei Shemayim. Usually in most verses it just says Yirei Hashem, it says Kol Yirei Hashem. So Kol, David HaMelech wants to make sure that we don't misunderstand, and clear that he's including both men and women in this description, therefore he uses the word Kol. Now, the word ashrei, which I'm translating as happy, and they're translating here as praiseworthy, Rav Hirsch says is from the shoresh of ashur, to stride forward. But a person is ashrei, a person is happy, if he's always moving forward towards his goals. If he's always striding towards his goals. So people have goals, and as long as they feel like they're moving toward them, ashur, they tend to be ashrei. People get unhappy when they feel like they're not moving towards their goals, and they're not striding forward. There's a phone company, famous phone company, that used to have a slogan for every radio ad that would say, make progress every day. Right? That was Verizon's slogan for many years. Make progress every day. Right? And he says that that's an ashrei person. An ashrei person, a happy person who's making progress every day. His goals may still be far down the road. But he's ashur, he's striding toward those goals, and he can feel happy about that. Such a person is praiseworthy. That's just walking his ways, a whole way to drop of. So, what exactly does that phrase mean? And of course you say that whole way to drop of, to walk in the ways of Hashem, means with sincerity and conviction. Now, how is a person not observe mitzvahs with sincerity and conviction? By rote. Walking in the paths of Hashem means you have to walk. You have to move forward. You have to take the stride. If you do things by rote and never really think about what you're doing, that's not holech v'drocha. You're not walking in the ways, you're standing. So happy is a person who fears Hashem and doesn't fear anything else, seeks his security in the correct places, and always is thinking about how to do what Hashem wants and concentrating on what he's trying to accomplish. The next pasuk in pasuk Bei says, Yegia kapecha, sisocha, ashrecha v'tovelcha. If you eat the toil of your hands, you are praiseworthy and it is good for you. It is better to earn for yourself than have to rely on tzedakah. A person who can somehow provide for their own food and needs has a much better frame of mind and a much better mental disposition than a person who has to rely on tzedakah. Chazal themselves were often involved in labor and praise labor extensively. The idea of working to earn your living, and there are many examples in the Talmud of members of Chazal who would do this or that labor, and they would carry their labors with them on the way to the Beis Medrash. And the Talmud in general has a very favorable look upon a person who does labor, and who does that labor in order to produce an income that will feed his family.
But why?
Now, a person only does his efforts, of course. Hashem completes the task and makes them successful. But nonetheless, a person has to get up and do their hishtavlus, has to make their efforts in order to do whatever labor is necessary to earn a living. There's a famous story about a shoemaker. And the shoemaker in Kabbalistic forum was praised as thinking great, great thoughts while he was making his shoes. So you might think, okay, he was, you know, secretly thinking of all kinds of mystical things. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter came around and says, you know what the shoemaker was thinking? That was so greatly praised as the highest thoughts. He was thinking, I want to do the best job for my customers and make sure I stitch these shoes correctly. That was the great thoughts that were bringing down the Shemayim that the shoemaker was thinking. labor is supposed to provide you enough to eat. And then, you're supposed to stop. There's a famous story that's been written up. Came to America from Germany. They told him he was going to a chasana, and they said, you can't give a bracha to such and such person under the chuppah, because he's a businessman. And so I said, well, I don't understand. He said, when he was in Europe, a businessman was a person who worked 3 or 4 hours a day at his business to make enough money to buy food and whatever, perhaps shoes and clothing his children needed, right? And then he spent the rest of the day learning. But because he spent those 3 or 4 hours in his trade, see, that was a businessman. And if a businessman worked longer than that, it was because he needed to make enough money to feed himself. There was no concept, says Rish Shimon, that you work in a business and keep working to try and make more and more money. Right? You work at your job until you have enough money. And then you stop working.
Hard to believe.
Right? Very hard to believe. So Rav Shlomo says he came to this country and he couldn't believe what a businessman here, he said, it's an avoda. You've traded in your avoda of doing a little work and learning Torah for doing a lot of work and learning a little Torah. This is because the person has enough to eat, but they don't stop. The goal of a business in America is to make as much money as possible. And to keep the business, that's not a business. So he says, now he understands. A person who's involved in such an intense pursuit of always wanting to make more money should be checked out twice before he gets a bracha under the chuppah. Right. But he says in Europe, he doesn't understand what they're talking about. Businessman, some of the most chashuv people in Europe were businessmen. The famous Sefer on Chumash, the Torah Tamima, written in the 1800s. Incredibly, incredibly chashuv Sefer. He takes every pasuk in the Chumash and he cross-references it with every Talmudic source. And then explains what it means in a connection. Right. He wrote it on his lunch hour as a banker. Right, so lunchtime, and then when he finished banking, whatever the time the bank was done, right? So did he try and buy a bank, make more money, maybe going to get a partnership, you know, get some investors, right? No, I work at the bank until I have enough money, and then I get out my safer and I work on my safer. Right? That's what it meant to be a businessman. So when we say that Chazal praise hard work and labor, they are not praising 80-hour work weeks, and they are not praising an obsession with money. They're praising people who want to go out and earn their own way. They're praising earning your own way as opposed to relying on tzedakah. And out of those 3 or 4 hours, maybe you couldn't always learn. Maybe you had to do other things. Maybe you had to help build the shul. Maybe you had to take care of the children. But the business was not, the business was something you did to provide for yourself. It was not an avoda to try and build up a business. And yet, there were still wealthy, very wealthy people. Yet none of them pursued their business with an avoda. Which tells you what? That if Hashem wants you to be wealthy, more or less effort on your part is not real. You put in the effort that Hashem wants. So how is it possible with these people doing this, they were wealthy people? You would think every single person must have been poor, right? Because there weren't any, there weren't anybody doing exact corporate takeovers. And there wasn't anybody doing the kind of, what we consider, oh, a guy puts in all this time, he's building his business, he's acquiring some other, he's doing this and that, or he's building his professional practice, putting all kinds of, yet there were people who were very wealthy. Because Hashem made them very wealthy on their 3 or 4 hours a day. So Chazal and David and Melech are praising a person who wants to rely upon themselves to put their own effort in, but knows when to stop. Rabbi Eliezer was one of the prominent chachamim in the Talmud. He was one of the richest people of his time. He had a worldwide shipping empire. Now, I don't know if you can picture in your mind the Mediterranean Sea on Eretz Yisrael, which is, of course, by the ports there and there where the at least there was a lot of trading going around that Mediterranean Sea. Woods, metals, timbers, all kinds of things. So he had ships going all over here. He had a huge shipping empire. Right. He never once was 1 minute late to the Beis Medrash, and never once left 1 minute of learning in order to attend to his business. His business will be what his business will be. On the other hand, Hillel was so poor that they used to charge Hollywood would be like a quarter or something, to go into the base measures, so that they could collect that money, get the wood for the fire and whatever. So Hillel couldn't afford the quarter. So he used to climb up on top of the roof and listen to the shearing with his ear laying on the roof. And one time after a big snow, the roof caved in. He came crumbling down with it. And they said, what are you doing? So I didn't have the quarter. So of course they took him in and didn't make him pay the quarter. If he'd asked, they wouldn't have let him pay the quarter, but he was humble and didn't feel that he was worthy of having them forgive the quarter, whatever it was for him. So that's interesting because one of the things people always use as an excuse for not doing things is, I'm busy with my living, I'm busy with financial matters. It doesn't matter whatever you're doing, it doesn't matter. People always have that reason. So we really can't do that. We have this and that and that. So there's no people alive today that are poorer than Hillel, and there are no people alive richer than Rabbi Eliezer. Yet it didn't deter them for one moment. The Talmud says that Hillel obligates poor people, and Rabbi Eliezer obligates rich people. Because people are poor, say, listen, I can't do these things. I can't be involved in learning. I can't do tzedakah. I can't go help your chesed organization. You know how much I have to work with that thing, and I have to go get the thing, and I have to. Well, you're not poorer than Hillel. And if you say, well, listen, the reason I can't do it is, I'm in my family business here, and I've got 87 trainees coming in today, and I've got, 37 government. Well, you're not richer than Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Eliezer managed to do it. Seek security in the things that you do. And if you eat from the toil of your hands, you're happy. But that means eating. It says if you eat from the toil of your hands. It doesn't say if you get rich from the toil of your hands. Now,
that's true.
There is a medrash that explains this entire capital from beginning to end is also referring to Gary, to converts. And well, we're not going to go through all of it. And there are a couple of very interesting midrashim. In this particular pasuk phase, the medrash that talks about Gerim says as follows. Sometimes Gerim, converts, think they have no schus avos. They have no benefit of Jewish lineage. So of what value are my accomplishments? So says the pasuk, Yagia kapecha, sofel, ashrecha v'tov lach. If you eat the toil of your hands, if you go out and do things for yourself, ashrecha, it'll be praiseworthy for you in this world, v'tov lach, and it'll be good for you in the next. But the pasuk is alluding to the fact, as are many of these came here, that a ger is a certain kind of feeling, and the pasuk is coming along to say, no, that's not true. If you do this, then ashrecha, you'll be happy in this world, v'tov lach, and Hashem will take care of you in the next. You can eat with the toil of your own hands, metaphorically. You don't have to eat with the toil of your Bubbies and Zadies and your great Zadies. And, my 15 Zadies ago was the Rosh Hashiva in Skablonski. Right? It doesn't matter. You can eat with the toil of your own hands. You can earn your own oil and have it. From scratch. Because converts often feel that they have no lineage. Right? And they have no schus from their past ancestors. So therefore, so says the Apostle, toil with your own hands and you'll eat the reward. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, it says, Eshtecha, so that's about earning a living. Now let's talk about getting married.
Oh. Okay. I'm sorry.
You're an excellent door person. In Pasuk Gimel, now we talked about earning a living, let's talk about getting married. It says, Eshtecha gefen horia biyarkisei veisecha vanecha kisile zesim saviv l'shulchanecha. Your wife will be as a fruitful vine in the innermost parts of your house, and your sons will be like olive shoots around your table. A lot of metaphors in this verse here. What do these metaphors mean? The first is your wife, should you marry it, will be like a fruitful vine. Yes. So what is a fruitful vine? How is that? What is the comparison between a good wife and a fruitful vine? A good wife allows her husband to go out and earn a living without having a heavy burden and feeling like he's overburdened, because the wife is taking care of the home and raising the children, and she's happy. And when she's happy, her husband goes out to work with a light heart and doesn't feel burdened. A grapevine is described in Shoftim as the kind of fruits that gladden Hashem and gladden mankind. Because, of course, from grapevines come wine. So the grapevine is described as something that gladdens Hashem and gladdens a person. So too, a wife gladdens Hashem and gladdens her husband. The number one most important thing for a wife is to always be happy. Well, he's going to give us more advice for wives and husbands as well. Then he says, she'll be as a vine in the innermost parts of your house. Now, most vines don't grow in the innermost parts of your house. So there must be something about the innermost parts on your house. The emphasis is on inner. A wife, she'll be a fruitful vine that you'll see, and you'll see her in the innermost parts of your house. Meaning that a wife reserves her being seen, her beauty, for her husband. And such a person, woman who does it, will merit tremendous children, the Talmud says. Today we have everything backwards. We get dressed up for a wedding, and we get dressed down around the house.
Right.
That's exactly the opposite. Who is it that should think you're the most beautiful woman in the world? The people at the chasana or your husband? Many times you'll see a husband and wife going to a chasana, and if you're real alert, you can pick up the husband looking at his wife. Like maybe he hasn't seen her in a while. He just saw her 20 minutes ago. Right? But he hasn't seen her in a while. Because what he sees, right, is the house coat, all right, and the you know, disarray this. Right now, she's all stuffed, she's going to the chasana. So I'm not, obviously, one doesn't have to put on a fancy gown when one is, you know, cooking food. I'm not saying, but we have the whole attitude a little bit backwards. The attitude is that a woman's beauty should absolutely be allowed to shine for her husband. The rest of the world doesn't so much need to see how beautiful you are. Now, of course, one doesn't go to a wedding looking bad, all right? And certainly, especially in our time, people would think that was a little bizarre. But nonetheless, you have to have the right attitude towards it. That where are you putting all your efforts in? Are you putting all your efforts in being attractive for your husband? Or, yeah, if I get to that, maybe, but I'm putting most of my efforts in being attractive when I go out. So it's a certain mindset. That this wife will be, you'll have a wife will be a fruitful vine. She will gladden you, and you will skip out the front door to go to work, happy to be relieved of any burdens. Okay, maybe the skipping might be a bit of an exaggeration. And when you come back, you'll realize your wife is so beautiful, and she only beautifies herself for you. And then what will happen to such a wife? She'll have children that'll be like olive shoots around the table. An olive tree is one of the few trees that cannot be grafted. If you ever, you probably, let's say, by Sukkot time, when you buy an esrog, if you ever study the rule laws of esrog, one of the biggest problems that historically has occurred when Jews move to new countries and new places is to identify whether it's a kosher esrog or not. Now, what is a kosher esrog? All right? I mean, it's esrog is an esrog. Maybe it has something wrong with it, but how could the whole species be unkosher? Because farmers graft various trees and fruits and plants together to form new species. An esrog that has been grafted together with, let's say, some other citrus fruit, they mix the seeds together, and they produce a new thing, an esrogitrus. And it may look exactly like an esrog, or it may look like a citrus. So sometimes something can look like something, but it's been grafted. It's really not that thing. There's one tree that can't be grafted. No matter how hard you try, you cannot graft anything onto an olive tree. It's hard to see and determine whether or not an esrog has been grafted onto or not. It's almost impossible. It requires a tremendous amount of investigation. A woman who conducts herself in the manner that we're speaking and reserves the inner beauty of herself will merit to have children that are like olive trees. They will never be subject to going astray from foreign or improper influences that you don't like. unless you think that's a simple matter, he uses the idea of the olive tree of grafting, because you can pick up that S robe and it looks like a beautiful S robe, and you'll never know that you just picked up an S robe that's completely not kosher because it's half citrus. It's hard to tell what influences come upon your children and what will happen to them 30 years down the road. So as David HaMelech wants to be like an olive tree, nothing can influence them. They'll be an olive tree all their lives. You never have to worry that an olive tree is part olive and part grape. That can't happen. You want them to be a straight path and let that influence. And David HaMelech is not saying a light thing here, because that influence on children is, that foreign influence, that grafting, is impossible to detect. There's a famous story, and unfortunately, I think at my age, my memory is just going, because it's a rub, and I forgot his name, and he's not long in the last, I guess I'm going to feel it. He was in Brooklyn. He was a famous mechanic, and he used to review the English textbooks that the yeshiva was using. It was like in the 50s, let's say. And they were trying to put together an English curriculum, and you know, there weren't any Jewish English textbooks, and almost everything in the United States in those days was Christian-based. So there would be a lot of things about, you know, various Christian holidays and stuff that they didn't really think needed to be in the yeshiva textbook. So, on the other hand, they wanted to have English. So they went to Rav Aaron Kotler, Zichron Tzadik Livracha. They said, what should we do? And he said, take out the parts that are offensive, and then if the book is okay. So they gave him a book, and took with the parts taken out, and he looked it over, and he said, seems okay to me, I don't see any objectionable things in here. And this Mechanech said, Rabbi, let me show you something. And he showed him where throughout the textbook there were subtle influences of non-Jewish ideas. And Rav Aaron Kotler said, I never got it. From now on, all textbooks go by him. Rav Aaron didn't pick up on it. That foreign influence is subtle, and it's impossible to detect. There's no way you can come home and say, today I exposed my children to a foreign influence. Or today I didn't. All you can hope is that your tefillos and your actions will result in your children being like olive trees, that nothing can influence them from the path you've set them on. And they'll be around your table, these olive trees, or these children who are olive trees. What is one of the biggest sources of nachas for parents? And the children are what? Aware. The children come home and sit around your table, and you see the results of all of your hard work. That's nachas. But it's not nachas for nothing. That's a reward. Hashem is giving you a reward. Hashem is giving you a reward of having your children sitting at the table, behaving like gentle ladies and gentlemen, doing whatever, you know, and choosing to be at your table. Chazal say, woe to a person whose children choose to dine at a stranger's table instead of his.
Yours.
So a child who comes home and you see, all that, is you remember all the things you put into this child, and I'm sure everybody can remember all the things they put into child rearing. They come, they sit, they grow, they act, and they're nice. That's not. These olive branches that stayed on the right sitting on my table. Right? That's not the stuff. That's your wife and children. That's what you're looking for. Rav Hirsch says that you see from here that, and he talks about the olive shoots, how olive shoots have to be carefully nurtured. And he says that the David HaMelech is also alluding to the fact that parents have to love taking care of their children. I can't really do justice to what he says there. I can only try and paraphrase that, you know, in his time in Germany, it was very common for people just to hire help to raise their children. What we would call a nanny. And the parents would be very not involved in the day-to-day child-rearing kinds of things. Right? And he decries that. He says you have to love to raise your children. Right? A farmer with this olive shoots, yeah, it can't be grafted. But to raise olive trees requires a lot of work and nurturing, and you have to really like doing it. If I say, okay, here's your job tomorrow, you're in charge of the olive trees, and you hate looking outside, you're not going to be a real successful olive tree farmer. have to teach yourself to love raising children at these olive shoots, and then they'll pay you back. Hashem will reward you by letting them sit around your table. Now, there's also another allusion here, Dovin HaMelech says, sitting around the table could allude to his son Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech had so many wives and so many children, forget getting them around a table. He couldn't even give them all proper attention. David HaMelech is alluding to the fact that this is wrong. That a person is supposed to give his attention to his children. And even if his son Shlomo couldn't literally gather thousands of children around one table, he had too many children to give them the attention and guidance that they need. The Das Seifrim says that that's one of the laments of Shlomo HaMelech in Koheles. That he realized that he was unable to properly raise his children. So then what will happen in Pasuk Daled? Hine kichein yivorech ha-gavr yirei Hashem. Such a man who fears Hashem will be blessed. Such a man, what is that such a man? Such a man who davens for all the things we just talked about. Who davens for his livelihood, for his wife, for his children. Such a man who davens for that and who fears Hashem, he'll be blessed. He'll have these things. And Pasuk Hey, verse 5, Yivracha Hashem at Zion, and Hashem will bless you from Zion. And see the good of Yerushalayim all the days of your life. So the goodness of Yerushalayim, it says B'tuv Yerushalayim, the good of Yerushalayim. There's actually a halacha. One is not allowed to say or think anything bad about Yerushalayim. One is required to only see the good of Yerushalayim and to overlook any shortcomings that may or may not exist. So it says you'll see B'tuv Yerushalayim all the days of your life. Meaning, hopefully, you'll be one of the people that will return with Mashiach to Eretz Yisrael. But if not, all the days of your life should have such a blessing. All the days of your life could still have this goodness of Yerushalayim in it, even if you yourself don't make it back to Yerushalayim. Even if you don't merit to be one of the people and to be alive when Mashiach comes, you could still have that goodness of Yerushalayim, that only goodness all the days of your life that Hashem will give you. Where it's only good and everything else is overlooked. And may you see children born to your children and see peace in Israel, on Israel. Besides the song that we sing in Shalom Zachar, I will spare you from my attempt to sing that day. I believe in the theory of keys, that every singer should have his or her own key and should not have to sing in the same key as anybody else. That one should express one's individuality when such an event occurs by singing in one's own key, in one's own version of the tune.
Sing it?
Shalom Zach. A bris also sometimes. It says, you children's children, you David HaMelech wishes to give you a bracha to see grandchildren. And that will make peace in Israel. How? That'll make a lot of happy bubbies and zadies. But it says, no, it will. When your children have children, it increases the shalom. There's no fight over inheritance. There's no yibum or chalitza. A person dies without children. Grandchildren is a big bracha. Not only is it a big bracha, it brings shalom al Yisrael. It brings peace to Israel. I don't see bubbies and zadies getting up and mixing it up too much. They'd rather play with their grandchildren. Grandchildren bring them. If your children are such a reward, more so even your grandchildren. Now, back to the Medrash that wants to explain all of the psukim here as relating to gerim, to converts. Urevanim levanecha, and you may see children of your children, see peace amongst Israel. Gerim are considered to be Hashem's children. A woman could convert. She could have a daughter. A daughter could marry a Kohen. That Kohen could have a son. Which would mean that the convert's grandson would be a Kohen, but will be able to go up into Duchen and to Bench Yisrael, the same as the Kohanim from all the way the time of Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron. As the Pasuk, children's children will be increased upon Yisrael. That your children's children will be standing in Duchening next to the descendants of Moshe and Aaron. Shalom al Yisrael. It doesn't say shalom to Israel, it's on us. Like it fell on top of us. Sort of like standing online. We were just discussing earlier that there's, you know, a New York saying to stand online. There's no such word as online like that. If you look it up in the dictionary, it says substandard English, often used in New York City. And literally, stand on a line would mean the people are in line and you're standing on top of them, crushing them. Which would be a little difficult to do. This came up. We recently saw a very successful book that's been published, and he said people were waiting online. By Al Yisrael on Israel, I know we got there for a reason. Right? Shalom, peace is on Israel. So, in my first year, peace is on Israel, because it'll be brought on Israel when Mashiach gathers all of us to Eretz Israel. The ultimate shalom, the ultimate peace in the world, will be when Mashiach comes, but not just amongst all the nations, which we've discussed before, but amongst the Jews as well.
Sorry.
Is that a question?
Yes. I thought a Kohen can't marry
a Kohen. Right, the daughter of the convert marries a Kohen. So the Kohen marries a Bas Yoris and then has a son. Sorry, I sure wasn't clear about that. So not only when Mashiach comes, it'll be shalom in all the nations of the world, but it'll be shalom on Israel as well. It'll be brought on us by Mashiach, right? And by the ingathering of everyone going back to Eretz Yisrael. It'll be hard-pressed to say that amongst Klal Yisrael, shalom reigns. Peace reigns. It'll be hard-pressed to say that peace and shalom is prevalent amongst all corners of Klal Yisrael. I don't think I'm going out on a limb by saying that would be a hard thing to say. Nonetheless, when Mashiach comes and brings everyone together, shalom will be brought out of Israel. It will be brought on to Israel by the coming of the Mashiach and everybody coming there itself, and everybody realizing that whatever petty differences they have are really irrelevant. That it will be shalom out of Israel. David Hamel is really down to brass tacks tonight. Right? Now, sometimes he's more esoteric. Here he's talking, listen, you gotta make a living, you gotta have a family, you gotta have a wife, alright, you gotta have a living that you can deal with, and he's out there, this is real powerful stuff.
You didn't answer the question that I was supposed to earlier.
Which was?
How ready you are.
Oh, I'm sorry, I meant to answer that question and I didn't, yes. So, David Amel says to earn your own living, however, if a person has the ability to be a Torah scholar, then the community has an obligation to support them. Because producing Torah scholars is a community financial obligation, the same as the community has an obligation to build a shul and build a mikveh and buy a sefer Torah. That obligation to support actual and potential Torah scholars. I mean, in Europe, a rav who had a position as a rav, let's say the rav of Hopsenplatz, right, his job was to sit all day and learn. And sometimes people would come and ask him questions. But in this village of 50 people, how many questions did he get a day? Right. I remember that Rabbi Berowine once said that in his mother's town, I think it was in Poland, there were 20 families, 10 Jewish and 10 non-Jewish. They had a rabbi of the town. But what was his job? His job was to sit there and learn. So Torah scholars, that financial obligation of the community, right, overrides this. So when we say that to earn from your own hand, it's as opposed to having to take tzedakah.
Right.
But you're taking money for sitting and learning Torah is not tzedakah. That's a holy thing that the community is obligated to do. That's not tzedakah. They're not supporting you because you're poor and cannot support yourself. They're supporting you because they wish to support you to enable you to learn further. Were the community to stop supporting you, you would have to go and earn your own living, and you should do that rather than have tzedakah. So he's contrasting here having to take tzedakah or handouts with earning things yourself, and having to take a handout, a person who's being supported by a
question is that every one of these in the light are not committed, are not potential committed or common, and the whole town can support.
So I don't know about either one of those things. I don't know what, I don't know which people are potential talmidim for chamim and which people are not. I will leave that at the yeshiva. And in terms of the financial underpinnings of it, I'm also not. I don't know the details of any of these particular situations, so I can't really say. I'm only telling you the theory. The theory is that being supported for sitting and learning is not like compared to taking tzedakah. The community has an obligation to support Talmid of Chacham. How many they should support, and how much they should support them, etc., etc., is, as they say, and the kids say today, above my pay grade. That's for others to decide. Right? But theoretically, a person who is a Talmid Chacham and is sitting and learning and is being supported by the community is not taking tzedakah. It's the community doing a mitzvah by supporting it. Who should be included in that, I'll leave to the to other debates. So the government is down to brass tacks, down to tafas. You gotta have some sort of, you don't want to have to be dependent on the doctor, you gotta have some way to feed yourself, you gotta have a wife who will enable you to have a happy home, and who will merit to have children, who will not be, will be like olive trees, and you should daven for all this, and then you can have all these good things in your life, even if you don't merit to see Mashiach, you still have all of these good things, and Shalom Al Yisrael. David Hamel is not in the business really of writing a marriage handbook. But here he almost is. I was trying to think of a way to describe it, and I saw a really good expression in Rabbi Rubin's book. And he calls it the smiling corner. He says, in most houses, you have a corner somewhere where there's a bunch of family pictures. And, you know, the family with this, and this and that, and this is where little Yankala was, and this is where went home, and put all the pictures together. Call it the smiling corner, because people like to look at the pictures of their family. And nowadays we have these electronic things like we have where you put a gazillion pictures in and it flips randomly amongst all the pictures. So I could stand there for hours and look at it. Right? Why? Because the family is supposed to be a source of chizuk, a source of encouragement. And the way that the family is a source of chizuk and encouragement is happiness and good memories. When people put up pictures in the corner, and sometimes you go in, and I remember that in my Bubby, Allah Shalom's house, over the buffet was one of those lace covers that, I don't know, seemed to, what? Doilies that seemed to, I don't know, for some reason, of a certain era, Bubbies were required to put those out. I don't know why exactly. I saw those, and on this corner of the buffet, there was a gazillion pictures stacked up everywhere. And there didn't seem to be any really order to it. It wasn't like, here's all the children, here's all the grandchildren. It wasn't like a nice, organized thing. It was like, oh, here's just pictures piled up every which way. They weren't all the same size. It was a clump of pictures. And she loved that corner. And she loved to look at them. Because that gave her chizuk and encouragement. At the end of her life, she was very ill. Rechman al Islam, she had liver cancer. There's no cure for liver cancer. It's very painful of them. Love to look at the smiling corner. The smiling corner gave her chizuk. And that works if you follow what David HaMelech is saying. The family should be a source of good memories and thus chizuk. The smiling corner is not just something that Bubbies do because they want to make sure they have pictures of all their grandchildren organized alphabetically. It's something that Bubbies do and that everybody should do. If I could, I would go door to door and tell everyone to have a smiling corner. Where you can look at pictures of your children and your family and your relatives, and you can get chizuk and encouragement from that.
You call it a smiling corner.
You can call it a smiling corner. And that's what Rabbi Rubin calls it. Now, it's a perfect description. It's a smiling corner, because when you go there and look at it, you smile. That's why you smile. It's nice. I like that. It's a pleasant feeling. Then, that's the chizuk that you get if you follow all of these instructions. If you daven for the fact that you'll be able to not have to depend on tzedakah for your living, if you daven for the fact that either your wife or you, depending on whether you're the wife or the husband, will be able to be a source of happiness and inspiration, to the family, and that your children will grow up in a proper manner, and that you'll be proud of having. You want that chizuk? Have a little smiling corner. Right? When you get all these things, the David HaMelech, it's not over yet. You're getting all these things, then you get more chizuk from them. When you get all these things, and you have your wonderful children, and you have your grandchildren, right? In some cases, great grandchildren. Put pictures over in the smiling corner. So look, I davened for all these things, and Hashem gave me two of Yerushalayim. He gave me the goodness of Yerushalayim. Even though I can't be in Yerushalayim, He gave me that goodness. I can do more. I can go on. I can do better. Look what Hashem gave me. He gave me two of Yerushalayim. So you could maybe call it also your two of Yerushalayim corner, or your smiling corner. But that chizuk comes from getting all of these things that a Yerushalayim person davens for. And that's how you get chizuk. We all have to govern them out. Saying in his practical advice to husbands and wives. Questions?